Welcome to Dragons, Gazelles, and Unicorns. I'm Rosemary Freeman, founder and CEO of the Center for Advanced Innovation, and I'm here today with Catherine Hill Ritchie. We are very grateful to have her on the podcast today. She is going to share a lot of great insights about, and actually the most tremendous example of an organization that truly has done technology transfer and monetized technology transfer. So Catherine, thank you so much again for being on the podcast today.
Well, thank you for inviting me. I'm just so excited to talk to you about this fascinating subject, and I'm glad to meet powerful women like you who are also in the industry.
Oh, thanks. So tell us a little bit about yourself, your background. You have an amazing background.
Well, thank you. So do you. You know, I think a little bit of background. Both my parents were research scientists at NIH, and so I think having that science background, even though I didn't want to do chemistry or physics and anything like that, but being around that kind of research and technology environment, you know, my mom even worked for a VC-backed biotech company when I was young. I didn't understand any of this then, you know. I thought it was totally weird, and I had weird parents. But anyway, fast forward to my career now, I think that left an impression on me. But still being a rebellious child, I of course didn't want to go into science originally because I thought it was nerdy and business was more exciting and finance and all of that. So that led me to more of a career path in investments in finance and Wall Street and New York. And that also led me to working in alternative investments, hedge funds, private equity, venture capital. And that's how I get introduced to the family office world, which I had no idea. Even getting an MBA, I didn't know what a family office was. They talked about high net worth investors, but even that long ago, I guess family office wasn't such a defined term. So that led me to 7 years in Geneva, Switzerland, working for a large family office, working on their investment portfolio, and then ultimately back to New York and the US. And then to my career today, working for a family office that has a large operating business in industrial design and engineering with a focus on tech transfer, life sciences, medical devices, things like that.
Well, we share a few things in common here. My father taught physics at Harvard.
Oh.
And so, yeah. And he used to teach me how to blow things up. So that was a little fun fact about my upbringing as well. And I was the same as you. I just wanted to go and make money, go into business, make money. And also I spent half my career outside of the United States, which I think you did as well. So how did you, tell us a little bit more about the inside track of your journey. What led you from one place to the next?
Well, I think the investments world to me was really fascinating. I had graduated undergrad with a degree in psychology and I wasn't quite sure, but what happened is I started investing in the late 90s to age myself. And of course, I invested in some technology stocks and I did really well. So of course I thought I was a genius and I need to pursue an MBA because obviously this is a calling. So just like everyone else, you know, the market went down. Luckily, I had sold some positions to pay for business school. So it was just timing. It was luck. But I think the investment world to me was always really fascinating. And I think that it seemed that there were, especially for women, they were really interested in hiring women. And I saw powerful women even running hedge funds. And I thought, well, this could be a great field for me. And then being introduced to the family office world was just eye-opening experience because a lot of these family offices are run like mini institutions. Mm-hmm. And I thought that, you know, that freedom is very unique to have the freedom to invest in whatever they want, you know, maybe things that they're passionate about. And so that led me to really network a lot within the family office world. I had started in New York, went to Geneva, and I really got to know all the family offices. And that gave me entree to speak at conferences all over the world, where I'd learn about all kinds of interesting funds or companies, and I'd be introduced to other family offices. So over time, I built this large network of family offices and knew what they did. And, you know, I kind of had an inside track because I worked for a family office. Therefore, people were a little bit more open about revealing to me what they did and their interests were. So that led me to eventually meet Nottingham Spurk, actually through another family office connection. And I just thought they were fascinating. And so that was almost 4 years ago today. And it's just been a fantastic relationship ever since.
Well, Nottingham Spurk is the poster child for technology transfer. And I, like I said before, showing how technology sitting on the shelf, locked in the in a dark room with dust on it, can actually be monetized and commercialized and really can make an enormous impact on the world. So that is really the poster child. I mean, I'm always standing on my little soapbox and saying, you know, we have only 0.01% of the technologies that we have on the shelf getting out there. And yet Nottingham Spurk has made their business grow dramatically as a result of finding the hidden gems and commercializing them. So tell us a little bit more about Nottingham Spurk. It's a fascinating company.
Yes,
organization,
I agree.
I should say.
they're fantastic people, just wonderful history. So John, the name Nottingham Spurk is two last names, John Nottingham and John Spurk. So they met at Case Western and after they graduated from, you know, they were designers, industrial design school. They moved into just like everybody else, moves into a garage and started, and that was 48 years ago. And they have done nothing but this since. And so it's a wonderful history. You know, I didn't quite understand even what they did until I went and visited their offices. My investment background and all of that was quite different. So some of their really famous products are in your home today. You know, mm-hmm. there could be 10 or 20 products, everything from the Dirt Devil to Spin Brush toothbrush to Little Tykes. So, over the course of 48 years, they've worked with all kinds of big companies, Fortune 100 companies, but also they've worked with entrepreneurs and PhDs from universities. So it's, you know, Case Western, Cornell, you name it. And this kind of collaboration and tech transfer has been fantastic because, as you know, and I know, I grew up with PhD parents. There are a lot of inventors out there who really have fantastic ideas, but you're right. They are on a shelf. They get a patent and then it maybe goes nowhere. A lot of times, just because you're a genius and you can figure out some technology doesn't mean that you're necessarily a good business person, or you even mm-hmm. know how to fundraise or start a company or be a good CEO. I mean, there are so many components. I think tech transfer has been, a really interesting pathway for Nottingham Spurk to really take fantastic ideas from the outside, pair it with their engineering design and their process that they have honed over 48 years. This basically vertical innovation. And even the building today is laid out in a vertical pathway. To really try to take these ideas from A to Z to commercialization. So, you know, they review all kinds of ideas. I mean, thousands of ideas every year. And I think that what they're really looking for are big ideas that can affect a large number of people and are really overcoming a pain point. Because people will pay for pain points. So if you solve a pain point, they will pay for it. But also, if it's a medical device, it could save millions or billions of lives. Or it could just consumer products, or industrial devices, it can make life easier for you.
Yeah.
And if you can accomplish that, people will buy these products.
So what's really interesting is, you know, we've done a lot of studies on why do startups fail, and how it's, what are the obstacles to getting the technology? First, you have to find it, then you have to assess it, then you have to get it. Getting it is actually kind of complicated sometimes, because sometimes it's misplaced. Parts of the technology is misplaced. And so we have a systematic methodology for identifying, assessing, and then getting the technologies with term sheets. What is the methodology that Nottingham uses?
Well, I would say, they don't want to focus on fads or niches or hobbies or anything like that. Is let's look at big ideas, big mm-hmm. pain points. And so
do people go to Nottingham, or do people come to Nottingham, or do they go out and seek it? Or
great
both?
Question. Both. So okay. There is inbound a lot, because also once people dig through patents, they can also see who created them. So over the course of 48 years, Nottingham Spork has created over 1,250 patents, and that's a huge number of patents.
Wow.
And 95% of those are commercialized. Just like your statistic earlier, if you go to the U.S. Patent Office, there are over 10 million patents issued. However, 5% are actually commercialized.
Yes.
So the rest of them are sitting there. It's just, you know this, and that's ridiculous. Nottingham Spork, it's the opposite. Over 1,250, and there are more every day, patents that they have created, 95% of them are commercialized, meaning they're functioning, they're in a company, they're on a shelf somewhere, like working. So that is the exact opposite. How do they do that? Well, like you have a process too, which is very important. They have a process, and that process mm-hmm. is, big market, big audience, also price. You can create the most fantastic widget that does whatever, but if it's $5 million, you've got two people who are going to buy it. So also it's price sensitivity, cost, the shape, the size. There's so much of a consumer or buyer focus.
Mm-hmm.
Where would you like this device? How do you want it to work? How does it look? How does it feel with the shape? These are incredibly important things mm-hmm. that add to the success. So even if you have a technology that works,
yes,
you've got to put it in, and again, we're not talking about software services here. We're completely device oriented. If you have to have a device that someone's going to use.
Yes. I need to introduce you to one of our startups, by the way, because
great.
They are having a difficult time engineering they can engineer it, but they're engineering this device that everybody on the planet uses. And perfect fit. Anyway,
well, that's what I'm here for, right?
Yes.
We want great ideas. We want great companies. And the thing is that the collaborative effort has always been at the heart and spirit of Nottingham Spork, because yes, they have incubated some ideas inside and had tremendous success, but they also want to team up with other, and mm-hmm. it could be a company, it could be a PhD in a university, it could be a private equity fund venture, it could be another family office,
mm-hmm.
anything. And it doesn't always have to be, another thing I want to highlight, it doesn't have to be a brand new venture. It could be a very seasoned, mature company that maybe some innovation could be injected.
Mm-hmm.
And it could be that we look for patents, we create new patents, but it could energize a company and really launch it in a new direction, launch it in a new market, repackage it. So, it's not only just startups, but that certainly is a significant part. But also there are ways to team up, one startup's technology with another and pair it together. But it's all about the collaborative spirit.
So that also brings me to another point, that we're launching a children's health challenge, actually.
Oh, wow.
And there's going to be some interesting devices in that challenge that have broad usage for children. That's another thing we should talk about later, too.
Sounds great.
Just switching gears for a second about, the family offices. How are family offices different from, venture capital, angel investors?
Great question. So, they're kind of an odd animal, right? So when I was in business school, for example, getting an MBA, there was not really a defined term. What is a family office? Today, that's very different. So over the course of time, I think family offices they're in a defined investor type. You've got endowments, foundations, private equity, mm-hmm. venture, blah, blah, blah. It's a defined term. Although what does that really mean within itself? So is it a particular net worth? Not really. Mm-hmm. I mean, ultra high net worth is defined by 30 million or more, but even then, and family offices are a really quite a different animal. A private equity firm, a venture capital firm, will have a website, will have maybe their portfolio, will have their defined mandate. I'm looking for companies with, you know, 5 million to 20 of EBITDA, whatever. I only look for software companies. The point is that institutional players make it easy for you to understand what they do. They make it quite clear. And they do press releases and announcements. And anyway, mm-hmm. so a family office doesn't have to do any of that.
Yes.
I think over time, the ones that are more institutional and smart have realized, well, you know, there's two thoughts here. One mm-hmm. is, which I had a very savvy media person explain to me, that if you don't control the message and get out there, then whatever out there people assume is true. So if you don't have a website or at least some communication about who you are and what you're doing, then people make assumptions. There could be rumors. Mm-hmm. So in some ways, in the past, a lot of family offices that I even worked for didn't have websites and it was not clear what they did. And part of that was they didn't want to be overwhelmed. And it's true. The minute you put your hand up, identify who you are and what you do, you're overwhelmed with deal flow. A lot of it totally inappropriate for what you do. You know, you could be looking for software companies and someone's selling you a hotel deal in London.
Yeah.
Like, why am I getting this? So that's an issue. But at the same time, then you're missing out on great deal flow and you're not part of the conversation. So over time, I think the opinion has changed in that you need at least, you know, take some kind of control and say, this is who we are and what we do. Still, not everybody does it. That's their choice. Mm-hmm. I think, though, that's a smart thing. And also something that has changed, too, about family offices is, you know, everyone assumed it's just the billionaires that are smart. And I would say I know a lot of smaller, if you could say small family offices, they are smart people. They've hired smart people. They're very active. And they sometimes are much better than the behemoths that you would assume just mm-hmm. because they're so large that they don't know everything and they don't necessarily hire the best people at all. You know, these family offices are individual. There's no real template. There's no real, you know, business plan. You know, mm-hmm. you know how, mm-hmm. you know, the legal documents to set up a PE fund or VC fund or hedge fund. Well, the family office world is totally different. So there are sometimes reputational issues. You know, people have joked about family offices mm-hmm. sometimes because they'll go on their boat for the summer and they're not going to respond to deal flow until they come mm-hmm. back. And that's not necessarily always true. So I think there are assumptions. But I think the most important thing is relationships, is that you really need to get to know them. You also need to get to know who the real player is within the family office, because mm-hmm. maybe it's not a family member.
Yeah.
Sometimes it is. Sometimes it's not. Sometimes it's a separate CIO, or it could be a completely different wealth advisor. So, but you don't know that information and they're not going to tell you that information right away. You got to build that relationship.
Yes. So I have to tell you, we work with several family offices, the Walton family, which is really interesting because they have a very prescriptive approach to exactly how they want to give out money. And they do a lot of research. A lot of questions, a lot of research. I was surprised about how much due diligence they did on us when we engaged with them. And then you're right, it's all about building the relationship. Yeah. And then I have a girlfriend who is part of a family office as well. And she tells me that she has to read these 500 page documents before every family meeting. Because everybody has a point of view on what they want to put money in, because they have this one pool of money they have to spend together. And then they all have their other pools of money and they get to decide what to do with that. But then together, you know, the head of the family, the father, wants to have shared interest amongst the children. So it is very interesting. It acts like an organization, but they're all different. It's fascinating. Exactly. To me. And they work hard. Oh my gosh. I get emails from my girlfriend, you know, in the middle of the night sometimes, you know.
Well, an interesting example that was explained to me, which made perfect sense, was, you know, not knocking institutional investors at all, but, you know, for example, a family office was on the board of a company with a VC, and realizing in conversation, you know, they had some voting they had to do and decide the direction of the company. And the family office said, well, you know, when you walk away, you still get your management fee, no matter
That's
what.
Right. Yep.
So out of the 10 companies you invested in, if 8 of them bombed,
fail,
you still got a management fee. I'm a family office. I just lost that money. Poof. So it was a different mentality. And I thought that was interesting because this is their personal money or their family's money. And so it's a different level of scrutiny. And also, I mean, sometimes it's a good idea, but rarely do people fire family members. So that means they're kind of stuck with their decisions or figuring out a way to either really support the family members who are doing a great job and then try to like sideline the ones that are, you know, maybe not contributing or distracting.
Yes. So Nottingham Spark is, how is the money structured? Is any of it structured in a foundation where they give grants, or is it all investments that they make?
Well, that's a great question. So, you know, one thing I want to emphasize is the split. So there's the operating business, which is still around today, 48 years at Industrial Design. They work with all kinds of companies and entrepreneurs, tech transfer. And then there's the family office side, which has incubated companies internally. So I would say that's how it's split. And so when we find, it could be once a year, we'll look at, I mean, all kinds of technologies and spend money prototyping and actually physically, not just the due diligence on paper or the site due diligence, you know, that's the kind of stuff I used to do all the time. This is actually like, does this work? Let's make it. Let's see if it works. Let's
I love it.
And that's part of it. And so that, but the thing is that in that, you know, that costs a lot of money.
Yeah.
We've got incredible machinery and tooling and prototyping shop and everything. But some of those ideas don't work. And so then that's it. It's the money was spent, but it was spent well because we investigated an idea. But then the ones that do well, maybe only one or so a year, will really pop up to that level of, okay, we've got the technology, the design, the direction. We have a jockey. It could, you know, someone to actually run the company. All of those things have to come together. And so, and then what we'll do is usually we'll spend that money, do all of that, build a due diligence room, find a CEO to run it, and then we'll go to a Series A. And then once it's a Series A, where it's accomplished, it's all the check boxes we have, then we'll go out to our community and just say, hey, look at this. This is what we've incubated. This is a great company. It's separate now. It's spun out. It's a totally different entity. It has its own CEO. If you'd like to take a look at this company, they're raising a Series A. Please take a look. Do the due diligence yourself. So there's no funds. We don't take in any money. We don't have a management fee or like, it's not that kind of structure at all.
And do you have equity in the company?
Oh yeah. So and founders.
Yes, founders.
So, and like, you know, with the tech transfer examples, those entrepreneurs or PhDs, they're taken care of too. They're part of that. So
yes, that's good.
They carry through, even though, you know, maybe they're not working anymore on the design, it was their idea.
So I find it fascinating. Remember I mentioned this study we did for Kauffman Foundation on why do startups fail? And we found that there are these 35 characteristics that have to be visible within the management team or on the team somehow, because it's really a capability gap. I mean, you can raise money if you have the right capabilities. And because you can always pivot, you know, if you have the right team and the technology isn't perfect, as long as you have the right capabilities in the team, you're good to go. So how do you govern the startups since you have, I'm guessing, significant equity in the companies?
Great question. So over time, well, board seats and also, so another thing to emphasize, which I think is important. So over the course of my career, I played different roles when I was investing, and sometimes it was passive. Like if I was a fund investor, I'd get a monthly or a quarterly update. That's it. You know, if we had a significant amount, then maybe we'd get a board seat, but really rarely. So I did a lot of passive investing, and this is much more active and hands-on.
Oh, that's great. So
the thing is, we get a lot of companies that come to us and say, oh, great, I have a widget I need $5 million. That's not a scenario we're necessarily interested in. We want to work with the company on the engineering and the design to make it better. Here's why. 48 years of experience, 1,250 some patents, and we have a whole process that's streamlined that has been successful. So if somebody just brings us a widget that's already complete, then we don't have any impact on it. And also a lot of times they're asking us to pay for mistakes, and they come to us for a 50, 70 million pre-mill evaluation where we look at that with that, my gosh, we could have done that for like 5 or 10 million. So why am I paying for your mistakes? So that's why we'd rather not do that. So Nottingham Spark is not a passive investor in funds, in companies at all. They've got to do some kind of hands-on work and be a part of that. So
let's say you spin out this company. It's raising the Series A. You have the whole family of Nottingham Spark there to help the company, essentially. That's wonderful. Yes. I mean, no better scenario for a startup.
Well, in this way, yes, because you've got the whole support. I mean, listen, there are standalone entrepreneurs that do amazing things. I mean, we see them every day. Mm-hmm. But having this alongside them, the staff of Nottingham Spark is over 75 people, engineers, designers, marketing people, you know, having that next to you is an incredible resource. And also because they've had thousands of successful product launches. So it's not just, we'll make it look better and function better. Oh, we know who to talk to at the big retailers or online or
the relationships
or the hospital. So that is unique.
So the manufacturing and the distribution, does Nottingham Spark do that?
So they don't manufacture internally, but they will find the best manufacturer for whatever it is that you're doing. And it could be anywhere in the world. Really, they have relationships with manufacturers all over the world. But I think most of the time it is the best manufacturer for exactly what you're doing.
Yes.
If need be, you can retrofit places, but I think that's what they find is the most successful and quicker to market.
So Nottingham Spark is really an engineering powerhouse.
Absolutely. Design and engineering.
Design and engineering.
And, you know, just creative, looking at things from a different angle and also seeing the white space and also talking directly to the consumer or the end buyer. You know, one of the fascinating stories I love was the paint industry, right? I mean, talk about...
Did you say paint? Paint.
Hasn't been innovated in 100 years. The paint can, right?
Yeah.
Guess what they did? Women. Do it yourself first, right? I mean, how HGTV, do you watch that show?
Yes, I love it. Yeah.
Exactly. Women buy paint, but they don't want to use a screwdriver to open it up. And then it's messy. You can't really close it. It's all waste. What do you do with that paint? So they had interviewed women, which is smart because women are a huge consumer. They influence like 90% of all purchases. And I said, one woman said, well, if I could pour paint, like I do my laundry detergent, with a spout, with a screw cap. Well, guess what? They did that for Sherwin-Williams and the stock took off. So, you know, it's a matter of looking at things. Sometimes they didn't innovate paint. They innovated
the packaging.
Innovated the packaging, delivery system.
And usage, right?
And the usage, exactly.
Yeah. Oh, so, you know, actually I have an area that I would like to see innovative in, which is the gym. The gym has not had any innovation for years and years and years. Yet there are products out there that, really sophisticated products out there that reduce compression on your back and your knees and allow you to have an extremely efficient workout. That's my goal.
That's a great goal.
It's a little side project that I have going on, but it's a very, very important to me.
Well, now that we're all staying at home,
yes.
We need to find ways to exercise. And but you know, it's so fascinating, Rosemary. If you look hard enough, so many things can be innovated, but people usually just kind of resign and say, okay, well, I guess this is the best of what this product can give me.
Mm-hmm.
And also sometimes investors don't want to spend the time or money to innovate, even though if they did, sometimes the results are just unbelievable.
Valuations go up and everything.
Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, looking at tech transfer, looking at innovation, and never staying stale, because if you don't innovate, somebody else will come along.
Oh, absolutely.
You.
So speaking of innovation, I have two additional questions. I'd love to hear your perspective on how you think the tech transfer field would, could, should evolve and innovate. What is your perspective on that?
Well, you know, I think with COVID and what's happening today, a lot of otherwise slow and bureaucratic processes to mm-hmm. get technology out are being streamlined, even with our government, for example. So I have, you know, been in touch in the DC area. There are so many government contractors and great friends that I have, and I've been more involved in how to get also some of our technology with the government. And what I've seen is there are all of these organizations that are asking the public and coming right out to universities and labs and asking for this technology. So that, I think they've removed these barriers, which is, and it's like a laundry list, and especially with sterilization and security mm-hmm. and things like that. So I think, I hope that now at the same time, you have to be careful. If you push things through too quickly without testing them, you can hurt people. So you don't mm-hmm. want to do that. But on the other hand, removing some of these barriers, and I hope some of them stay
removed.
Will then in the future allow tech transfer to possibly happen more quickly.
Yes.
I also think, I mean, not to blame universities, but sometimes universities, you know, my parents were academics too. There is a focus on white papers and mm-hmm. that kind of recognition. And
versus the commercialization.
Yes.
Yes.
It could do well, so well for the university or the inventor, but there seems to be a disconnect there. So I don't know, but I'm hoping there could be something in that area that it helps to get that tech transfer out, because there is so much fascinating technology stuck in these universities and it's not helping anybody sitting on
the shelf. Yeah. So, you know, obviously what we want to do is innovate the technology transfer field and be the broker, so to speak, the hub and spoke to get those inventions out. So we we're going to continue to do that. But every year we continue to change the process and innovate and make it more systematic, straight through processing, you know, all of that. What's really interesting is that we are working on a public health threat challenge in October.
Oh, wow.
In October, we found all these great technologies that would address public health threats. And we met with one of the top biosciences organizations around the DC area to see if we could partner with them. Well, we're still working on the partnership deal, but man, had we launched that, that would have been incredible for the atmosphere here. Really would have been. There are a lot of technologies on the shelf that could actually help the current environment.
Absolutely. One thing that happened with one of our portfolio companies is, you know, the FDA has had a history of fast tracking when necessary, mm-hmm. but the EPA really hasn't. And mm-hmm. now the EPA is looking to fast track. And one of the companies they did was one of our portfolio companies around sterilization, which is fantastic because otherwise it may have been sitting there for 6 months going through or a year going through EPA approval. And so this sterilization company, it's just fantastic. Cornell PhD was, you know, kind of it didn't move for about 10 years.
Wow.
And
that's so typical though, isn't it?
Exactly. Nottingham Spurk was like, oh, this could be a real game changer. So also taking the technology, injecting it into a company, and then getting a CEO who's an expert in sterilization, who ran public sterilization companies. And, you know, so we're going to that. That's a perfect example of a tech transfer pathway and process where then we went to the hospitals and talked to nurses and doctors. How would you use this? How does this help you? Wow. And, you know, I think there's a little bit of arrogance sometimes mm-hmm. with inventors or technologists because they think they know what you want.
Everything. Yeah.
Not everybody is a Steve Jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what
right,
I mean?
Right, like, right.
And so you need to ask people what shape, what size. So that's where that's gone. So this machine can sterilize anything. It can sterilize. This is one of the dirtiest things actually there is. And the problem
she's holding
is,
up an iPhone,
you know, is also it's in here. And so this machine, when you pop it in, it's like a vapor. You could think of it. Inside. Anyway, but it can also do fabrics. They've seen MRSA, you know, which is one of the hospital acquired infections, on fabrics on the curtains between hospital beds. So it's very difficult to sterilize a lot of these things. This is the only machine out there that does. EPA so smart to fast track them, because if we can get this machine into hospitals, nursing homes, everything, they can start to sterilize everything, even blood pressure cuffs. I mean, badges, stethoscopes. Anyway,
so how about your skin?
Well, that's the one issue. So we have been able to use the technology for wound care and sterilization.
Okay.
But you can't stick a human into the device.
Maybe
never.
All right.
But we can sterilize everything else.
I can squeeze in there.
Exactly. Not yet. So
Little children in there. Oh, sorry.
But I do think, you know, again, EPA fast tracking things, I think will also help tech transfer, maybe speed up a little bit, because they realize they need all these technologies, and they've been not, you know, sterilization, not very sexy, right? 6 months ago. I mean, it's important. It's affected our lives personally. And a lot of people who've been affected personally were very excited about this technology. But now with something like COVID-19, it's just unbelievable, the need for it. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad that we have that. But, you know, we're always looking for more.
Well, so what do you think the new normal is going to be in the family office environment and the future?
You know, I've seen some good things. An initiative I've started, so I lead a family office group in New York City. And listen, there's bad news and bad news every day, right? So
yes.
I thought, let's actually highlight some people doing some good. So there's some family offices that are really doing some really good, interesting things. Here's the thing. A lot of people lost money in the public markets, but there's still a lot of rich people who are still going to be rich, and they want to do something to help. They don't know what to do. So I've seen really fantastic, just rallying efforts to either, you know, buy masks and personal protective equipment and donate them, because maybe that's all they can do.
Right.
If they don't have a science background, what can they do? Or another group was doing direct lending at zero interest to medical facilities.
That's wonderful.
So I think people are being creative. You know, Nottingham Spark actually, a fantastic engineer at Nottingham Spark, collaborated with Case Western and Penn State, and they created a new face shield. The problem with the face shields is that some of them were 3D printed, and everyone's in love with 3D printing. There are great things about it, but it's not actually the end all be all. It took 3 hours to 3D print this shield.
Oh my God.
And they figured out how to cut one out in 40 seconds. So,
nice.
You know, it's like, let's redesign it, but also let's look at everything, the process. And also a lot of these couldn't be sterilized. That's an issue. None of people had masks or face shields, and they were reusing them, which they're really not supposed to do.
Yeah.
So Nottingham Spark with the engineers and the schools figured out a way it can be made basically in, like, you know, a couple minutes. You can assemble it and it can be sterilized. So I think, you know, everyone is doing the best they can in the way they can. Not everybody has 75 engineers and designers on staff, but it's fantastic that Nottingham Spark was like, oh, let's help in this direction. And I've seen other families doing their best too. You know, landlords, you know, family offices that own buildings, not charging rent. Mm. And so, you know, I think that's an initiative that I really want to highlight is look at the good that's happening.
The humanity.
And contributing to food banks. I mean, that's another thing too. Maybe you're not able to be a part of all those other things, but you can always give money or food to a food bank, which is obviously very helpful.
Yeah, I think that people are just looking at people as people, you know, whereas many times I think that, you know, if you're really, I think for pretty much anyone, right? You sometimes walk by someone and you don't really think about the humanity. And so you're seeing that come out a lot.
Absolutely.
There's a lot of good news to this as well.
But I think a lot of people are thinking about, you know, there are all kinds of gaps even in a hospital setting. And I think the tech transfer, there's going to be a lot of interesting opportunities where people say, oh, look, we can take this off the shelf here and input it there. And so I think, you know, people smarter than me are going to put together some really fantastic technology.
Yeah, we actually have a proposal out to do a blueprint on all the unmet needs that are present for public health threats. And, you know, you take that blueprint, you prioritize the unmet needs, and then you systematically, you know, what we do is we pull all the patents out of the USPTO, the WIPO database, put them in a big database, harmonize the data, augment the data, and then apply, do a multidimensional segmentation analysis. Then we start to apply our due diligence filters. And we could then, we can really quickly identify technologies that could directly address the parts of the blueprint.
That's great.
So we should then partner with you, and then you guys can go engineer it, design it and engineer it. Yes. So I just wanted to thank you very, is there anything else you'd like to leave the listeners with today?
Well, I want to thank you for inviting me on. I'm so glad that we could have this discussion. I think that tech transfer is fascinating. You're working in such a fantastic area. I think there's a real need for collaboration to bring in all the different players, because very few people can do it alone. So you need the different people with different expertise, and definitely Nottinghamsburg is looking for ideas outside of and companies. And so I want to make sure that people know that we're open. We are open actually now too, because we make medical devices, we're an essential business. So we are open and looking forward to talking to people about their ideas.
Excellent. Well, I want to thank you so much for sharing information about your background, your amazing life and Nottinghamsburg and technology transfer and family offices. You've provided us a lot of valuable insights to the listeners today. So again, I'm very grateful for your time.
Well, thank you. And I look forward to leaving my home and meeting with you in person sometime very soon.
Yes, I hope so. We have
but
that
in
meeting
the meantime,
planned.
Stay safe and be well. And everyone in the audience, wash your hands.
Yes. It's been about 20 minutes now. It's time.